Hello and welcome to Positively Progressive. I'm Alan Minsky, the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. On this week's show, the host and creator of Positively Progressive, Donna Smith, speaks with a truly positive progressive, Junie Joseph, who is the state representative in the state of Colorado from the city of Boulder. And of course, Boulder, Colorado, where the University of Colorado is one of the most forward-thinking and progressive enclaves, not only in the state of Colorado, but in all of the United States. And not surprisingly, the good people of Boulder have elected a truly innovative and inspiring representative. And so Donna is speaking today to a truly positive progressive. And then later in the show, in the best of the story, Donna speaks with Andrew, who is a public school teacher and educator from Thornton, Colorado. And he speaks to Donna on the eve of his 30th birthday. Last week, we heard from a slightly younger progressive. And now we hear from Andrew, who has been in the public education system for more than half a decade as a teacher. He loves his job. He loves his students. And he has many ideas about the direction our society and country needs to go. And they are truly progressive. In every installment of Positively Progressive, I chime in to let folks know what's going on with PDA. And of course, there's a lot going on with PDA right now. We're sort of in the home stretch of the process by which we determine the candidates that we are endorsing in the primaries in 2024. And that's always exciting because we learn about new, great, exceptional progressive candidates running for federal offices across the country. And you out there will be hearing about them through us in the coming weeks. On top of the PDA chapters across the country determining which candidates they will be endorsing, there's a lot of other stuff going on with PDA. We're introducing great initiatives like our Rural New Deal. We're advocating for a 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. And as always, we're campaigning for progressive public policies and legislation, both federally and across the land. But of course, I'd be remiss if I did not acknowledge this moment in history in these past 2 months have been defined by the horrible violence in South Israel and Gaza, and indeed elsewhere across Palestine. PDA has taken a very proactive approach to the crisis, where among a number of progressive organizations that are calling for this immediate ceasefire and demanding that the administration pursue a ceasefire. And I'm very excited about a guest that we're going to have on our PDA town hall that, as I record this, will be taking place tomorrow. We're going to have an Israeli-American historian named Omer Bartov on, but I'm particularly excited because he has been an advocate for something that's sort of between a one-state and a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine. When I first heard about it, I thought it made a good amount of sense, and as I've learned more about the proposal, it continues to make a good amount of sense. But even more than that, Bartov is adamant that we should be calling upon the United States government and the Biden administration to not only demand a ceasefire, but to demand that Israel and Palestine begin negotiations that are long-term negotiations that again pursue a long-term settlement and an ending to this decades-long crisis. And so we're very excited about this upcoming town hall. I mean, we may very well be spearheading a progressive initiative to demand that the Biden administration insist that serious negotiations are restarted between Israel and Palestine. So that's some of what's going on with PDA. There's always so much going on with PDA, and nothing more important than this fantastic new podcast, Positively Progressive. Take it away, Donna Smith.
Donna Smith at Positively Progressive, and I'm so excited today. We're going to have a wonderful interview. Our third show, we first had Tom Hartman, and then we had Nina Turner, who was amazing. And then I thought, because we're concentrating on the positive aspects of what progressives do in this world, I wanted to talk with someone who has really taken that to heart and into action. So today we are joined by Junie Joseph. She is a state representative here in Colorado, but that's not how I first met her. And I know the audience is going to want to hear more about and from Junie. Good morning, Junie.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Thank you. And because many in our audience do know you if they're from Colorado and with PDA, but a lot of people in the national audience don't know you, and now they're going to. So tell me about you. Tell me your background. Where did Junie Joseph begin her journey, and how'd you get where you are?
Oh my goodness, that might take a lifetime, but I'll give you the shorter version. Well, I was born in Haiti, and I grew up in Florida. And I went to University of Florida and got a bachelor's in political science and anthropology. And then I went to England and got a master's in human rights. And I moved to Colorado, actually, and got a law degree. And I failed to mention, I have five brothers who live in Florida, and my mom lives in Florida as well. So
you're the only girl in the family?
I am.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's where I learned a lot of my leadership skills, because I was the number one babysitter because I'm the eldest as well. So yes, that's how I learned
You said you studied human rights in college. What lit your fire for that? What was it that told you that was a field you wanted to study?
Yeah, I think from a very young age. So I feel like the law picked me. I didn't pick the law, and advocacy picked me. I didn't pick advocacy. You know, having been born in Haiti, and as you know, it's a very poor country, and there's a lot of political and economic and socioeconomic dysfunction. And I think growing up there, seeing a lot of poor kids, it really just, I don't know, it lit something inside of me that said, hey, I think I want to work in that field, in the human rights field, to help kids, but also to help the community that I was growing up in. So I think since a very young age, I knew I wanted to be in this human rights field. And, you know, once I get to the U.S., I was focused on really getting an education in that field, which was political science in the human rights field. When I went in after I got my master's, I had the opportunity to intern with the United Nations. And then I went to work for them as a human rights officer under their UNV program. But ultimately, I think the idea for me has been that I really wanted to be in community, and I wanted to be part of the solutions when it comes to the problems that we see in our society.
Wow. Don't you think that's almost the definition of being progressive, is that you want to move forward on the issues? I think we share that as from a very young age, when I would watch things happening in my own community, even though I was born and raised in the Midwest. When I saw that there was so much injustice around me, you know, people who were not born with the privileges that I had. I was not a wealthy kid at all, but I had a stable family, and I had siblings, and I went to school, and I had a safe home. And that's a big difference from what a lot of people in this world will ever get. And I was the only sibling in my family that the fire was kind of lit. And I'm not sure why either, except that it just didn't seem right when I saw people suffer. And I knew that there might be a better way. And it sounds like that was kind of the path for you, too. You talked about the UN, and I wanted to mention something to you about, oh my gosh, it must be now. As you know, the UN does a report on human rights around the world every 10 years, right? Every decade. Mm-hmm. And just when I was starting my work on Medicare for All, they were about to do that. And the United States was submitting a report. But several of us worked on a shadow report that would come in from other agencies and places. And one of the issues we concentrated on was healthcare and what was happening to people in the United States around healthcare. So I'm thrilled to know maybe you were in there somewhere in the mix when all of that was going on. And that's awesome. So do you have a family now? Or do you live with a family? Where do you live now?
I live in Boulder, and I'm single. I don't have a family at this time.
Uh-oh. That'll be a notice to lots of people. You're so wonderful. So why did you decide you wanted to run for office? What was that all about? Where'd it come from?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is the thing. As you were talking earlier about, you know, growing up in the Midwest, and you felt a sense of injustice in what you've seen in your community. And I was, as I mentioned to you, I was born in Haiti, and I saw the same thing. And I felt, even as a child, I knew there was an unfairness in the poverty that I saw around me. And that motivated me. And I think that's the thread that connects all of us, is that no matter where you live, it seems that there's injustice everywhere. Whether you live here in the United States, or you live in Haiti or other countries around the world, it seems that there are some people who take more than their fair share, right? And because of that, good people or decent people have to work really hard and advocate for the rest of the community that is not at the table. So for me, when I moved to Boulder, I was living in Africa. I lived there for a year. I was living in the Central African Republic. And if you know anything about the Central African Republic, around 2017, they have been having conflicts. There was a conflict in that country. So there is a civil conflict happening there that is along the line of it's economic, it's religious, it's political. So it's a difficult state that I was living in. And I was working as a human rights officer, as I mentioned to you earlier, and I really did enjoy the work. I love advocacy. I love doing human rights work because I felt there was a need for it. And it became increasingly difficult living in that country. And I did feel that my safety, I had some safety concerns, personal safety concerns. But also part of the reason why I came back to the U.S. is because I already had a master's in human rights by the time I was working there. But a lot of my colleagues had law degree. But the thing as well, too, when you work for the U.N., I notice a lot of my colleagues have at least one Ph.D., if not two. They were highly educated. And it really didn't matter where you're from, whether you're from Africa, Europe, North America, it really didn't matter. People were highly educated and highly trained, because a lot of the people who work for the UN are truly passionate people. They're passionate about having the right skills and the right knowledge to do the advocacy that they were doing. And I was there and I only had one master's degree. So I thought to myself, I wanted to be more effective. And part of the work that we did was along the line, both human rights and humanitarian law, right? Because it was a state in conflict. So there was that bumping between human rights and humanitarian law, and you had to know a little bit of both. And for me, I was struggling actually to put a lot of these issues in legal terms, legal international law terms. So I thought to myself, even though I did a good job, my boss, you know, was a great supervisor. And when I told him that I was going back to law school, he asked me why. He said, did you not have the right skills? And I thought, well, I think I want to go back and learn more. And I thought as well, that was a privileged position as well, because here I am, educated enough, and I wanted to go back. And I think I read somewhere that you don't need to be overly educated to help others, right? It's you just need to have the passion and the heart for the work. So ultimately, I said, I'm going to come back to the U.S. I'm going to get a law degree in order to better serve who I want to serve. Especially, I understood that as well, that the world is made of laws. The United States is very structured. If you understand the law, I believe you are much, much more effective at asking for what you need and what you want. And I think at the international space, it's the same thing. A lot of the countries where the UN work, they don't have great legal administration, but nonetheless, the UN system itself understand issues in terms of rights. And these rights are imbued, or, you know, these rights came from laws, right? Man-made laws. So I needed to understand that. So I came back to Colorado, But as I was coming back, I made this vow to myself that even though I'm coming back to Colorado, a very, very safe community, to Boulder, and, you know, I thought, gosh, I'm going to leave the Central African Republic and I'm going to leave the people behind. I was serving about 75,000 people. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, if you've never lived outside of the United States, I don't think you've seen poverty, the type of poverty that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought with that level of poverty, I still had to make a commitment to service. So I said, I'm going to come back to Boulder, but I will continue to serve. And, you know, I'm a bit religious, by the way. I am. I'm as a Christian, I prayed before I left.
I'm actually glad to hear that, Junie. Sometimes progressives hide that, don't we? Because it's not always, it's not that it's not acceptable. It's that it's such a personal thing, right? And thank you for saying that. I share that with you. I am also a Christian.
Thank you. Yeah, and my faith, and because of my faith, I wanted to still serve. And coming to Colorado, I realize we still have the same challenges. I mean, not the same, but similar challenges where, you know, we had housing issues and we still do in Boulder. We have living wage issues in Boulder as well, right? In a very, very progressive community. And here are some of the things that we're dealing with. We have certain people are at the table and they're deciding for others and they don't know the community at all. So when I moved here 1 year into my law school experience, I decided to run for city council.
And what year was that, Junie?
That was in 2019.
Before the pandemic. So pre-pandemic, you got,
yes.
Wow, you got set up to have a rough run there through that time, right? And how was that serving on city council? How did you find that?
I really enjoy serving on city council. I really think city council set me up, right? Because city council is closest to the people.
Yes.
At the state level, a lot of people in the community, they don't know what I do over there at the Capitol. But city council was the baseline. It sets the foundation. It taught me that council members are the real advocate for the community. If you want to know what's going on in a community, go speak to a council member. They'll tell you where the potholes are. They'll tell you what the people in the community are concerned about. So it really set me up. And not only that as well, council members and mayors, and they have a very, very close relationship, not just in the state, not just in the region, but also nationally. So council members, I think it's really, really one of the best, if not the more powerful job that a person can have, because you're so close to the people. And that's what the job is about. It's about helping people. And if you're helping people, you better be close to them to know what their needs are, as opposed to, you know, you work thousands of miles away in DC and you legislate or you don't, right? Because sometimes there's just so much pomp and circumstances with being an elected official that sometimes that in itself seems to be enough for some communities and some of the people who do the job.
Yeah. So how hard was it to run? Did you find it difficult to run a campaign, or did you enjoy it? How did you do it? Did you just build volunteers around you? What did you do?
Yeah. I think part of the job when I ran for city council that informed, currently I'm a state representative, is that I had to talk to a lot of people in the community, and I was very lucky. I was a student. I'm still a working class woman, although I'm a lawyer. It's hard for student working class people. Boulder is
wealthy.
It's very wealthy, and it's you know, there's not as much diversity in our community as we would like, right? Yeah. It's only 8% Hispanic and less than 1% Black. And that 1%.
Wow. Black, I didn't realize that. Wow. Whew.
Yes. Yes. And that 1% Black only exists when we are a university town. It only exists when the university is in session. So when there is no university, when the university is not in session, it's even less. And I usually make the comment that there is about 57 Black people in Boulder, and I know all of them, except for Coach Prime. I don't know him very well, but, you know, hopefully we can add him to be the 58th member of that, you know, of our Black community. So the idea was, for me, I knew that I had to lean in on my experience and engage community members. But I ran for city council as well, especially when I talk about the demographic of our community, right? It's majority white. There are few diversity here in town, but I think everyone understand a sense of fairness, right? And I think even with the way our demographic looks, people truly, I believe people in Boulder, they strive for having a community that is inclusive. And I ran on that. And I ran on the fact that we need to have more of a diverse community. I ran on the idea of socioeconomic diversity, because that's extremely important, right? To have people of all social class involved in the politics of the everyday life. And I think people, you know, they got to know me, they got to know my experience as a former human rights officer, and they believed in what I was selling, if that makes sense. And I worked for them really hard on city council.
It makes a lot of sense. I know you may be too young to remember, but those of us who've been in Colorado a long time, maybe they still do, used to call Boulder the Republic of Boulder, because it was like a separate entity, in that there were a lot of intellectual people there, a lot of very educated people there, and they did tend to lean left compared to a lot of the state. So it wasn't surprising that, you know, for instance, our current governor, Jared Polis, is from Boulder. You know, Joe Neguse is in Boulder, you know, and now Junie Joseph is a state representative in Boulder. So how you made that transition and that run during the pandemic for state rep, didn't you?
I ran for state rep last year. So yeah. That was 2020.
Just towards the end of the pandemic. Yeah. Yes. Tell me about that. How was it?
Yeah.
How was the run? How was the candidacy?
So I ran, I don't know if it's the same thing in every state around the nation, but I ran through a vacancy, or through the vacancy process. So there was a prior rep in the seat, and she decided to step down after the primary, just a little bit after the primary election. So that created a vacancy as opposed to a regular election or primary process. And I was picked by, I believe there were maybe 60 or 70 people in that vacancy. And part of it, again, was just having conversation and meeting with them and telling them about the work that I have done in the community. And again, I lean on my experience as a former human rights officer, as a council member, and I was picked out of 7 candidates, I believe.
Wow. So when, now we're going to shift to a real hard subject for most people to talk about. When did the King Soopers shooting in Boulder happen? Were you a city council person or okay. Unfortunately, Junie, you and I share some close connection with mass shootings. One of my sons was working at a restaurant when, shortly after he left, this was Chuck E. Cheese Pizza, it will now be 30 years ago, a gunman walked in and shot and killed 4 people and injured the manager. And so I'm pretty familiar with the gun violence issue, and we're certainly still seeing it all over the country with the recent Maine shooting and all of the shootings everywhere. What was that like for city council when that happened? Tell me what your reaction was, and now that you're a state rep, can we do anything about gun safety regulations? It seems so hard everywhere in the United States to do anything about the gun issue, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about it and how it was when you went through that.
Yeah, I think, thank you for asking that question. I mean, I think, as you mentioned earlier, Boulder is very wealthy. We are very educated. We have a university in our town. So we are very intellectual, and also we are a safe community. It has been safe. And I remember
it was shocking. It was shocking, right?
Yes, it was not just shocking, but it disrupts this sense of safety that we all had in the community, because it happened at a grocery store. We all go to grocery stores. It didn't happen at a gun range, because if it did, you could say, oh, this would never happen to me. If it happened, let's say, at a club, because we had a club shooting, you could say, I've never been to a club. If it happened maybe at a certain other establishment, you can say, you know what? I don't fraternize those type of places. But a grocery store, we all go to the grocery store to get our, you know, subsistence for the day, for the week, for the month, for our families. That's a place we go. Even the elderly, there are times I have elderly friends. They just go to the grocery store to go and
to get out. Yeah.
To get out. So the grocery store is a part of the community. And to have that happen there, it really made all of us feel as unsafe. It made us feel unsafe that anytime, at any moment, it can be one of us. And I remember right after the shooting, I opened a Zoom, because it was during the pandemic and people attended. And, you know, we were just talking about exactly, you know, how we felt, you know, that, you know, this shooting happened in our community. And I think as well, another part of it that was deeply saddening is that this gentleman was not even from Boulder. He was not from Boulder. I believe he was from Aurora, another community. Mm-hmm. Yet he came
to Boulder,
act here in our community. So it really, safety when it comes to gun violence, you can't just say, oh yeah, we are a smart community. We are a safe community. We are wealthy. We'll never be impacted by gun violence. You can't say that, especially not after since that shooting happened in 2021. So it deeply affected us. We did pass, Boulder City Council did pass in a ban as well. And the state capitol, we have been really working on a lot of gun violence prevention laws. There's no assault weapons ban at this time, as you know. And we did have a state representative who tried to introduce that, Rep Epps from, I believe she's from Denver. She did try to introduce that.
My rep. Yeah, she's my rep. Yeah.
Yes. She did introduce that piece of legislation.
Well, I'll bet she got attacked a bit.
Yes, and it died in committee. So again, you know, there is an opportunity to reintroduce that bill. I will fully support it. Boulder support an assault weapons ban. We support all gun violence prevention measures. I passed my own last year as well to ban ghost guns. But banning ghost guns itself is not enough, right? We need to pass legislation to ban assault weapons. We live in communities together, and it's not just to use inflammatory language, but weapons of war we have no reasons to have those type of weapons in our community.
Oh, and I agree.
And these type of, you know, high capacity magazines, weapons are weapons of war. We should not have them in our community. And I fully support reintroducing the assault weapons ban. And I fully support Rep Epps and her efforts to do that.
Tell me, you know, I think about this a lot since the situation with my son's work. I was at a support group one time for the families affected by that. And a woman walked in and sat down, and when she introduced herself, she was the mother of the shooter. Mm. And all of us had to take a big, deep breath and imagine for ourselves what it would be like to have a child who somehow went off the rails, mm-hmm. and did something so horrific like that. The whole thing was so awful, it was hard to think about. But it makes me think, and since you know so much about human rights, much more than I do, what is it in American society, do you think, that is propelling us to have so many of these violent acts? Is it mental health? Is it drugs? What is it that you think? And I'm not going to hold you to this. It's all, you know, thinking about it as people and as human fellow humans. What do you think? What do you think's going on?
Yeah, in a country like the United States, a first world nation, we should not be having these type of mass shootings. And I think that's a great question that you asked me. And I don't think we would have enough time to unpack, right, the root causes of some of the issues. It's familial, it's societal, it's the person as well, right? With mental health issues and the type of healthcare system that we have and we provide in society. And I remember I talked to a friend of mine once before, and I said, the job that I have only allowed me 3 visits to the mental health professional. And after the 3 visits, what do I do? Right. So
yeah, I guess you get well, right?
I better, right? So, yeah. But I think if we set aside all these other societal issues that we could blame it on, access to guns is the biggest problem.
Yeah.
If assault weapons did not exist, we would not have mass shootings. Someone once said to me, oh, well, maybe the person could use a knife. Really? I don't think someone can kill that many people that quickly with a knife.
Nope.
So really, the X factor in all these issues are the weapons, the availability of weapons in the United States, and the gun manufacturers and the lobbies that lacks any type of, I would say, humanity, right? Humanity for us and for our community. We need to do more at holding these type of companies accountable, the gun lobby, and also the gun manufacturers as well. I really believe with all my heart, they are part of the problem. They are the main reason these crimes are happening in our community, because, you know, there are other places where people have those same issues. We're humans, you know, there are poor people everywhere. There are people who have mental health issues everywhere, but not all of them are committing these type of mass shootings. But in the US, we have access to high capacity magazines and these type of weapons. And I think it makes it easier for community members with mental health issues and other problems in our community to commit these atrocities.
Yeah, I so totally agree. Thank you for thinking so deeply about the issue, and I trust you're going to continue to work on it at the state capitol. But now, before we finish our interview, I want to transition to you and your campaign in 2024. And I would bet you're going to run again. I hope you're going to run again in 2024. Of course, I see you going a long way. I see you being lifted up a long way. And I hope that somewhere in your heart, you will have the strength and the passion to do that. But tell me about 2024, and what do you need from people around the country to make sure that Juni Joseph stays in office?
Thank you so much. And I think you're very kind to me. Thank you. I am so excited. I am so grateful and honored and delighted to be serving the people of Boulder. I served them for 4 years on the city council, and I strive really, really hard to vote based on those values that I proposed to them when I ran for office. And at the state level, I have done the same. I passed 19 bills last session.
Wow.
About 7 of them were my bills primarily, and the other 12 were other members' bills coming from the Senate, from the House, that I have supported, that I have worked on directly with these other members. We've talked about gun violence prevention. We've talked about, we didn't talk about renters protection, which I worked on as well. Access to justice and keeping families together. I'm on the child welfare committee as well at the state level. To me, serving people is what drives me, and that's what wakes me up in the morning. I feel closest to God, the God that I serve, through service. And I will continue to do that as well. I, as a member of the Democratic Caucus, I care deeply about LGBTQ plus rights. I care deeply about reproductive health. I passed one of the biggest environmental legislation in the nation, actually, at the state capitol. So I am doing the work. I want to continue to do the work because I have the passion for it. I have the drive and the will to do the work. I already have my bills ready to go this year. I'm working on early childhood and childcare bills because we do have a childcare crisis in the nation. Again, the work that I do my best to inform myself, to learn about what our community needs in order to best serve our people. And I think as a community, I want to make sure that you come along as well as part of the work that I do. I am just grateful. I'm just so excited to continue to do this work. And what do I need from community? For those in Colorado, reach out to me. If you have any questions about any of my bills, pick up the phone, call me. Go to my website, Junie.
Yeah, tell us the website so we can reach you.
JunieForColorado.com. You'll find my cell phone is there as well. You can text me before you call, but I do have a number where you can reach me at any time. And I am fundraising. I need help because I have a primary. I have another woman in the race who believe that that's the job she wants. I can understand that we want certain things in life, but I have the passion to do the work. I have done the work, and I have done the work successfully, and I intend to continue to do it. And I hope I will get your support financially or, retweets and letting other people that you know in Colorado, in Boulder, to also vote for me. So I'm just excited, and I want to continue to do the work. Thank you.
Oh, of course. And those of you out there listening nationally, I know there's lots of you out there, please go to Junie's site and donate some money. I mean, that's the thing that fuels campaigns, especially when someone's an active community member like Junie is. I know she knows a colleague of mine I used to work with at the University of Colorado, Judy Amabile, is a state senator from Boulder. So, there's a lot of good work coming out of Boulder, but we have to keep Junie in office. So, and that requires some money because some of those other lobbyists will want to give lots of money to other causes and other people. And we need as people to fuel campaigns like Junie's. And finally, my last question, are you thinking any about a future? Are you thinking about your future service beyond the legislature? Any dreams you have right now of what you might be able to do?
Ooh, well, here's the thing. At this time, I'm living my biggest dream. As someone who was born in Haiti, as I mentioned, I came from a very humble beginning. And here I am serving at the state legislature in Colorado, serving the people of Boulder.
Pretty wonderful.
That is living the American dream. And, as I mentioned to you, as a working class woman, to have a seat at the table to help and serve other people, that is my dream, and I don't see anything beyond that. But whatever vision that God has for me, I hope that I can meet and rise up to that challenge in the future.
Wow. Junie, thank you so much for being with us on Positively Progressive. You are an inspiration as a woman. You're an inspiration as a community member. You're just a wonderful person to have with us in Colorado and nationally. And I hope as everybody listens to this interview, they will hear the same kind of wonder and joy and humanity in this woman that she brings to her work every day and brings to us as progressives. Thank you, Junie, very, very much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Donna Smith at Positively Progressive. We're back with the best of the story that follows our interview with Junie Joseph, a state rep in Boulder, Colorado. And today I thought it would be really awesome. I love to talk to generations that are different than my own because mine's getting a little stale in some of its thinking. So I thought maybe we should talk to an educator, a teacher, a public school teacher, about things that are going on in the world. So I want to introduce to you one of the public school teachers in my life who I know, and his name is Andrew. And Andrew is in Thornton, Colorado. So Andrew, tell us about you. What do we want to know about Andrew?
Well, I know this is going to be my 7th year teaching at my school. Well, five years there, but seven years total. So what?
What school are you at, Andrew?
Denlanche. It's an awesome school. I love it. Gonna be turning 30 here tomorrow, as you would know. Ooh. Big 3-0.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been enjoying it. I teach math. It's been real fun the past couple of years. So yeah.
7 years of teaching. What grade level do you teach?
Seventh grade. Seventh.
Seventh grade. Good Lord. Middle schoolers. So
they're great.
What's the most challenging thing for you as a teacher?
I the same thing that you probably most teachers would say is time. Not enough time in the day to get through everything.
What's the best thing about teaching?
Oh, getting to know the students. Getting to know them personally. Like last year I went to the PE class and ran the mile with them, and they just love seeing the teachers out there. I love seeing the students. They're just, that's the best part.
And have things changed since the pandemic kind of ended? What's different for you now?
The biggest difference is with the COVID, we did see a big learning gap that happened, especially in elementary school. And we're seeing that now in middle school. And a lot of it comes from, I think me personally, is the self-confidence that the students don't have anymore. They probably had a very difficult time, especially in mathematics, doing content remotely. And then I see that now that they don't have self-confidence, but they're doing the math correctly. They know what they're doing, but they always want, am I correct? Am I correct? And I think that stems from some parts from the pandemic.
What about socially? Do you see them having a little more trouble socially with one another? Or
at the first year that we went back from remote, I did see some students having difficulties. Now, this is what, like, two or three years afterwards, I'm not seeing too many social behavioral issues, all that. Like, they're also 12 and 13 year olds. Like, I remember when I was 12 and 13 year olds, I always had issues because, like, you know, big family, brothers and all that, we just goof off. And so I don't see anything too worrisome about that.
A tougher subject for me is, do you have to do active shooter drills with your students?
No, we do not have to do active shooter drills. That our drills are secure drills where we have to get the students away from the windows, like the doorway window, out of sight, out of mind. And those could be active shooter drills. It could also be, for some reason, animal got into the building. I've got to make sure the students are safe as well.
Do they get scared about that, or do they just take it? It's part of what they have to do now.
It's what they have to do. They know it's serious. They've done them pretty much all their lives. Every single year we have them.
Doesn't it seem a little sad to you, though, in a way?
Yes, but I am also part of the generation where we had to do them in school ourselves as well. So for me, that's kind of the norm. And it's funny that you're actually bringing this up, because we actually had a professional development day where all the teachers got into different generations, like every 10 years and all that. And we actually talked about, especially after Columbine, So the previous 10 years teachers that we were based off of our graduation year talked about Columbine and all that. And then when they got to us, it's like, oh yeah, we totally had to do that. And we just thought that was normal. Apparently, like, some other teachers were like, yeah, when we did our shooter drills, they actually kidnapped a couple students and then had them dress up in blood and then crawl back into the class. And like, I was like, whoa, we don't do that.
No, that seems like a little too much reality to me.
All the teachers are like, oh my God, really? And like, yeah. So another drill that apparently happened was the drunk driving drill, where they took two people, kidnapped them, had a crash car come in, and yeah. As a
Wow. Wow. I know for my generation, of course, I'm a boomer, but my generation, we did a lot of drills around bombs. And, you know, I don't remember being so scared as confused, because I remember thinking, if a bomb comes, how does it help me to be leaning up against the locker with my head up against the wall? You know, once I got a little bit older, I thought about it a little bit more, but I suppose every generation has their thing. You know, it's different, and it's very difficult for kids to, I think, internalize what does it mean if somebody were to come in here and threaten us somehow. And, you know, you're very good. I think you exhibit a real sense of safety for the kids, and I think you probably find that important, right?
Oh, yes, most definitely. You could ask any one of my students, like, what comes first, and all of them will say safety first, because they know that. We do have a lot of drills. Like, we always do our fire drills. They know that. They know that, to get in line, the tornado drills, lockdowns and all that, they know what to do. Especially the tornado drill, I don't know if you know, like, 2 years ago, we actually had a tornado touchdown or whatever, and we had to actually go through the drill at the end of the day, first Thursday of the school. And it's like, see, this is why we do the drills, so we know what to do. And the students, every time we had a drill that year, they're like, okay, gotta do it.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. All right, now a little bit broader question about public education. How do you feel about public education versus charter schools? What do you think about that issue?
I think it's fine. I like public school, public education a lot. My part of my student teaching was at a charter school, in Greeley, and I don't know. I like where I'm at. I like the schools that I've taught in. They've been great schools. I love the school I'm teaching in right now. I haven't really taught in a charter school. I do know that I don't know. I like my school. The school
like
I'm at is
I
like to
like
teach.
Teaching.
Yeah, I just like teaching. I have never taught in the charter school, so I don't have that background to be like, oh yes, public schools blah, but charter schools blah. I don't have that background.
Yeah. I guess. Do you think in any way if there's charter schools, it takes away from what you're able to do in the public schools?
I can see that happening. Yes. I do know recently there's been something about school vouchers, and like the government, like I haven't looked too much into it. I just heard a little bit from colleagues and from the news and stuff like that about school vouchers, where like you get something from the government and they pay to go to the charter school. And that's like taking away funding from the public school, because October count is a big thing for public school. That's how we get our funding. So more kids who get this government funded charter school takes away from funding from us. And that could cause some real big issues. And we don't want that. We want the public, we want it to be public for everyone to come to get an education.
Absolutely.
Like
it's like
that.
The basis of a sane society. Of course, we're a little bit in the air with that sane society issue right at the moment.
No comment on that.
Yeah, I figure you can't make much comment about that for sure. For sure. It just seems so to me. It seemed to me like only the rich kids when I was growing up would go to a private school, like a country day school or something. And that to me seems so odd. And now there seems like a proliferation of different kinds of charter schools. And I just would hate to see it take away from, you're right, the funding that communities give to our public schools, because it's so important that every child have access to that, you know, and be able to have an equal footing in life.
Yeah, I know, like, I don't think, as right now, I don't think I would probably go to a charter school as a teacher. I like where I'm at. I feel like the students have more, I don't know, are more real and like talk to me as a person instead of just a teacher, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The relationship building feels more authentic in this school. I'm able to actually make those relationships with the students. They know, like, tomorrow's my birthday, and they're like, ooh, what if we got you like Dr. Pepper and Kit Kat, my two favorite things? I was like, yeah. Once again, I don't know how charter schools would compare, but I feel like they have stricter guidelines in my, always in my mind, stricter guidelines. Like I remember when I was in college, I watched something about a school in New York or something, and it's like 90 plus hours, but you get paid like six figures and all that, but you better be doing this, this, and this. And like, we have our standards and all that.
Of course.
And like, I follow those standards to the dot with what my district gives me. And like, but I have some leniency on what I, how I teach it, especially at the school I'm at. I have a lot of leniency. Like one of my professional developments, which is actually a huge thing, it's called Building Thinking Classrooms, and it's completely different than the typical, as I like to put it, sit down, be quiet, and listen. It's literally like I took away the desk and they work on the whiteboards and all that, and I have way more participation. But I feel like if I was at possibly another school, it would have been like, why are you doing that? No, they need to be in a seat. No, you need to have the seating chart to be exactly every day so that they have to sit there. And I think I'm saying it's that authoritative figure at where I'm at. I don't have to be that. I am their mentor. I am their teacher. I know what I'm doing, and they trust me as I trust them. And
that's pretty remarkable. That really is pretty remarkable. I think, you know, for me, and I think probably for you, certainly, since you went into a teaching profession, there are teachers you remember who were able to touch you personally at a time in your life when you really needed it somehow. And I can't think of an age where children need it more than when they're kind of transitioning from that little kid kind of stage into young adulthood. And it's really a hard time. It can be a really hard time, but it sounds like you try to make it a little fun, a little interesting, you know, and a little more warm for them so they don't feel alienated.
Well, so the thing that, like, yes, I am a master of my content and all that. But students have such imaginative minds, and like, they could come up with how to solve my math problems without me actually telling them how to do it, and they're mathematically correct. My whole goal is to get them to be like to get them to understand why it works, and I will show them what I think is the most efficient way for them, but it's really up to them to figure it out. And that's going off on the warm side. Yes, I want to have the students' background. I want to use the students' backgrounds to help them and like expand on that.
Are you in a union? Do you belong to a union, Andrew?
Yes.
And what do you think of your union?
I think they're great. They have set up multiple times with meetings to make sure what our rights are and all that. Our union rep at school is also very adamant and helps out whenever we need it. My colleagues I work with, they're big with the union as well, because previous school districts that they were at, there's a whole fiasco that happened and the union helped them, and I haven't had any issues with them.
Awesome. That's good to hear. It's really good to hear. Colorado Education Association is probably one of them involved with that, but that's really cool. Now, a little bit more personal. Now, you said you're turning 30 tomorrow, which is hard for many of us to believe, 30 years old. However, you're also a dad, aren't you?
Yep, 21-month-old.
Wow, amazing, amazing. Little boy, Ethan.
Yep. His name.
Tell me, what world do you want for him, Andrew? What do you dream for Ethan? When you think about it, when he's your age, when he's on the verge of turning 30, what do you dream for him?
So the first thing that comes to my mind right now, that daycare does not cost as much as it does right now.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the first thing on my mind, because, oh my God, That's a lot.
It's awful,
but,
isn't it?
really, the opportunity to do what he wants, not what he has to get by. I know a lot of people where they're like, I have to go to this job. I just can't stop and do what I need because I need the money to pay my rent, to buy my foods, to do this, do that. I want him to have the opportunity to try and figure out what he wants to do and then go with it. But that's a big, big thing. I want that for my students as well. I want them to try to be these great things that they want to be. But it kind of seems closer and closer to impossible.
Why? Why? Why do you think that?
Everything just costs so much more nowadays.
The economic system is really rough right at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just like going back to daycare. $2,000 a month is roughly how much we
That's
pay.
Crazy. That's more than some people have for a house payment.
Yeah. So that's just one example. This inflation just, I don't know, just keeps going up as of right now. I'm no economic expert or anything. Not
Me
saying
either.
I am. But I'm just noticing like the regular prices, like milk has gone up, eggs, all that. One of the things I do with my students each year is when we get to our percent units, we look at Zillow, because they have housing prices on it. And I always go, okay, let's look at it 10 years from now and 10 years in the future, like calculate if we use that same percent of increase, that it increased from 10 years to now, how much would it cost? And like even the housing market has increased. So just that, like your biggest bill, your housing increases by so much. Even renting, like where I live, it's like $2,000 to rent.
And that's not necessarily a great place either.
No.
You know, that's just what people can afford, you know. If you could tell elected officials one thing that you wanted them to really concentrate on, and I don't care which party or whatever, if you could tell the people elected to represent you what you wanted them to work on, what would you tell them?
Fund the public schools. Like fund the public schools. There's so many students who could do so many amazing things. And like, I know a couple times it's like we got cut. Like recently we had to get rid of a counselor because numbers or something. And it's like, we need more counselors. We had to get one of our security people in the school. So we had to go down. It's like, and like the we had to, and now we're down to one, and like all these students were upset because they love this guy. Like we're K-8, so they've known him all the way through elementary to middle, and then the next year he's gone, and like, ah, oh, why, and stuff like that. So like, fund the public schools. The students, like, the biggest thing I remember from my childhood is school.
Yeah.
You
of
know.
Course. I mean, that's a great message. I mean, start, you know, they say all politics are local, and I think that's so true. If you don't have, you know, if you don't have the money to run things, and how foolish to have to cut counselors at a time when kids are under a lot of stress. You know, we see teen suicide and all those things being a bigger problem in the schools. So it's really, really hard. Andrew, thank you so much for talking to us. Is there anything else you would like to tell boomers about what our generation is leaving to your generation? What would you say to us about what we've either goofed up or done well? What would you tell boomers?
That is such a big question, because I would just say, how about you just trust us now? I'm 30. I don't need my hand held anymore. I don't think. Like I will still go to my boomer grandparents for advice, but I need them to trust me. I need them, like, boomers need to trust us on what we're going to be doing next. And let us try to fix some of the mistakes that you have made, because we're human. We all make mistakes. Nothing personal. But
okay. Some people need to take it personally, but yes, you're very tender about that. You know, I remember my dad, and this is a long time ago for you, 1992. You were born the next year. But my dad had always voted a certain way. And I was on the phone with him. He lived in California at the time. And I said, "Dad, come on." I was trying to convince him of a different way to go. And he didn't say much. And he went and voted. And he called me back. And he said, "It's all yours, kid." Which to me meant that he had made that transition to the saying, you know, it's because I said to him, "It's not about us anymore, Dad. It's about your grandkids. It's about my kids and what world we're going to leave to them." And you know what, Andrew, listening to you, I think the world's going to be okay. And we need to listen. You're so right. You're so right. We need to listen to those of you in the next, at least one generation down, if not two, to hear the ideas and the passion for what can be done.
Most definitely. I don't know if you know this, part of our STEM model is problem-based learning. And one of the things is taking a real life problem and trying to find a solution. And the students have came up with so many wonderful solutions. One of the big ones that they do when part of our training is, several years ago, there's the like national park in the Rocky Mountains National Park or whatever, needed a way to get people to come in, but their parking lot wasn't too big, so they needed a way to do that. And one of our students came up with, "What if we had city days where certain cities would go up?" And apparently that worked out for a while. So, like, yes, listen to younger generations. We have that creative thinking. I might be losing that. I'm hitting the big 3-0. But the younger, maybe not yet, but the younger generations have ideas. And if the older generations just shoot them down all the time, like, "No, that's not going to work. No, that's not going to work." How are we going to learn? Either it will work, or we're going to fail so hard that we're going to learn and try make a new idea, make a new attempt at making things better.
Awesome. I can see why you're a good teacher. You know, you really have a passion for being kind and being thoughtful. And I so appreciate your coming on Positively Progressive, and hope you'll join us again to talk more about these issues. And thank you for taking your time, Andrew. It means a lot to me.
No problem. I really love talking about what I do. I love it.
I can tell that. And it's so awesome to hear somebody who loves teaching. It's, you know, it gives you some hope, some real hope for the future and what the kids are seeing. And I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, I love when I tell them I teach middle school and everyone's like, "Oh, God bless your soul."
That's it's because, like, I knew what I was like in middle school.
Thank you for listening to Positively Progressive, brought to you by Progressive Democrats of America. To find out more about PDA and Positively Progressive, go to pdamerica.org. And please tell your friends, family, and coworkers about Positively Progressive. I'm Alan Minsky, on behalf of Donna Smith. Until next time, stay positively progressive.